Listening here on KXL 139, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program, along with Peter Evers. Again, I am Chris Ryan, and the show presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health, caring for the behavioral health of the community. For information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. We are here with Peter Evers, the CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health, and today the focus is going to be on suicide and cyberbullying. And we're going to have a guest who has done amazing things coming out of a tragedy that is unthinkable.
Yeah, Chris, when you think about the things that can happen in your life that are unimaginable, I think the loss of a child through suicide must be the biggest. I've spoken, of course, to many parents who have endured this and are constantly amazed by how brave those folks are, how they manage, how they get through, how they nurture their own children, their other children through this. But also how they have decided to go out and message what this is like. There is so much shame that is involved in that. And for somebody to stand up and say, look, let me tell you this story and let me help you avoid getting into a similar situation is remarkable.
No, I agree. I think that the loss of a child, period, is the most unimaginable thing. The blame that goes along with and self-blame, which in my view is it's prevalent, it's going to be there, mm-hmm. but is not necessarily well-placed, is something that is unimaginable to me as well. And, to see an individual like our guest, Jason Bazemore, who lost his daughter, Hannah, to a suicide 2 years ago, come in and discuss this and try to create a positive outcome as a result of that, I think is really significant. And I think that, there's a lot of things to always talk about in regards to suicide. And the first and foremost thing is when an individual gets to the point where they feel there is no return, to know that there is a return. Mm-hmm. And particularly for individuals who are going through, a severe depression or depressive mood that they have not felt before, and they feel like they're spiraling, that is the time to reach out to help and not to give into the moment.
That's right. I mean, and that's that idea of imbuing in individuals hope, that there is a hope for the future, that things will turn around. We have a phrase in the business which is, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And if you keep hammering away with that message, I think that's the right thing to do. But the other thing, of course, is be mindful of how you behave with other people. And I think that's a great message that we're going to hear. Always assume that somebody, the things that you may say may be overly hurtful and somebody may be overly sensitive to that.
And I think that we're at a point now where we are really starting to see a change in how mental health is viewed. And I think a lot of that has to do with the amount of individuals who have come forward who are high profile and are talking about this. And we're still at a place where you're not going to see, an incredible amount of individuals step forward because the stigma is still so strong that they rightfully, in my view, fear for what's going to happen first in regards to employment. And they feel that individuals are going to judge them and that they may be denied a job in the future or be able to continue to move up the income ladder if they are honest about their mental health. But you see a lot of individuals like Gordon Hayward of the Celtics opened up about his mental health issues. DeMar DeRozan, who is with the Spurs, has talked about that. Kevin Love with the Cavaliers. And, of course, Bruce Springsteen has talked about this extensively for many years, Billy Joel. And, these individuals are they everybody has, when there's stigma involved, something to lose, but they're comfortable in doing so. And as they are comfortable in doing so, then we're going to start to see changes. And to me, the important end goal here in regards to suicide prevention from a mental health perspective is the prevention piece. And that is creating an environment where mental health and physical health are on a par, where if a person's back is hurting, you're comfortable talking about that. But if you are having issues of anxiety and depression, there's a chance, or perhaps even a good chance, that you're going to hide that from your physician and from your family and from your coworkers.
Absolutely, yeah.
But if your back's hurting, you're like, yeah, I got back spasms today, so I'm a little bit irritable.
Yeah, let's normalize it.
Yeah, and so before we bring in Jason, I want to talk a little about cyberbullying and your feelings in regards to that, because I think, as we talk a lot on this show, the important piece is to look at these problems in totality, as opposed to looking at, the specific problem and not looking at the why. And with cyberbullying, the focus is generally on the victim and castigating the person who is committing it. But in my view, there is mental health issues at play throughout the entire process. And the bully is doing this as a result of their own conditions and are, going after a individual that they view as being vulnerable, in order to make them feel better about themselves and their own circumstance.
Yeah, well, I mean, as with anything, knowing the root cause of the behavior is the solving of the problem, and you're absolutely right. But, there are occasions when there is this sort of group bullying mentality that in cyberbullying that raises up, and I do think that people should be held accountable for that in some way. Because we know about those cases that are high profile where there has been some legal action taken against individuals. We don't know about the other ones where people say, well, it's just a misdemeanor and it doesn't make the news. So I think it's a question of messaging about understanding the beginnings of that behavior, but also holding people accountable. And I really think that's a part of the cyberbullying. It is not okay. It is not okay to do this and get away with it. There will be consequences. I think that we have to look at that.
No, I agree. I think that we have seen through the course of our society things that rise to the level of criminality, and that when those things do rise to that level, when you push forth a punishment that makes that is so severe that you weigh the risk reward, individuals are less likely to commit that right. crime. And just because an individual may have underlying conditions of mental illness does not mean that you can go out and kill people.
That's right.
So the same thing, or rob a store. So the same thing occurs in this particular instance. Just because of the mental health issue that may be at play, that doesn't give you the right to hurt others in that instance.
Which is absolutely in line with our recovery principles. We don't just accept that somebody has a mental illness, therefore we give them a pass. We expect them to participate in their recovery. And that's the trade-off. Recovery is possible and real, and you will behave within the constraints of any society, and that's the right way to go about it.
That is Peter Evers. I am Chris Ryan. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 139, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. In return, we'll be joined by Jason Bazemore, who is going to discuss a tragic circumstance around his daughter in Brookline 2 years ago. She took her own life as a result of mental health issues and also cyberbullying. Back with more after this. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 159, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. I'm Listening presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. We're really excited to be joined on the program today by Jason Bazemore, who's going to tell us the story of his daughter, Hannah. He is from Brookline. And 2 years ago, Hannah took her life as a result of cyberbullying and underlying mental health issues. Since that point in time, Jason has been an advocate for raising awareness on the issue and is joining us on the program to discuss. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Good morning.
Great. Appreciate you joining us for the show. So first, tell us about Hannah and take us through who Hannah was and how things reached the point that they did.
Sure. So first, I would say Hannah was a beautiful young girl, just your all-American kid, which I think is one of the things that makes this so impactful when we talk to this about other kids or other people. So Hannah was a 16-year-old girl. She was ranked in the top 10 in the country for competitive shooting. She had won the New Hampshire Young Scientist Award as an eighth grader, as top award in the state, straight-A student, varsity cheerleader as a freshman. You know, one of those kids you see that's like an all-American kid, you know, everything going for a really pretty girl, popular kid. And yet there was some underlying mental health stuff that just never presented itself. My daughter and I were very, very close. When I say close, I have been mom and dad for a long time. So we had those tough conversations about what was and was not sexually appropriate behavior with a boyfriend. You know, she had to come to me for those things, even teaching her how to shave her legs and armpits. So we were close. There were still things that she wouldn't share with me. There were things that, you know, until after her death, we didn't know. She had some journals that she had left behind with some writings that you could see. There was definitely some depression there that had probably been there for a long time and just never presented itself. In hindsight, she was almost like a Robin Williams, always had a smile on her face, always laughing, wanted to entertain everybody, and I think that was her way of kind of hiding what was really going on.
And Peter can talk more to that, but I think a lot of times kids keep things in, and in particular, if there's a difficult environment around them, they will try to be the sunshine in the particular moment, and that carries a weight. It's difficult to entertain everyone and make sure that everybody else is doing well. And a lot of times, you don't think about yourself as that individual, and you can fall into depression, particularly if there's underlying issues.
Yeah, well, Jason, first of all, thank you so much for coming in. And, you know, I'm so sorry for your loss. I know that the people listening just cannot imagine how that would feel. I think one of the things that really is extraordinary about what you're doing is you're actually telling a story. You're raising your head above the parapet a little bit to say, you know, this could happen to anybody. And, you know, your reference to a kid who is sparkling, who is achieving, I think is resonant with a lot of people because everybody worries about this, but we don't talk about it.
No.
And I think you're doing that is incredibly important. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you address this issue. I'm also interested, you know, how the grief process works here, because here's somebody that was as important to you as any human being on the planet, and you have managed to move through that. I think a lot of hope. I'm hearing this idea of making a difference, making an impact, rather than sort of retracting into yourself, which I think is the first thing that you must think of to do. And if you can talk about that,
sure.
That would be wonderful.
Well, I will say I'm blessed in a sense. I have two surviving children. Mm-hmm. I have sole custody, sole decision making of my children. So I didn't really have a choice. I had to be strong for them. They needed somebody to be there. And I think sometimes tragedy shows us a strength we never knew was there. Mm. So that was a large part of it for me. The other part is, how do you make sense of something like this? You know what I mean? This is this beautiful girl that, like you say, she meant everything to me. She was my mini-me. And for her to be gone, you know, to try to make sense of that, I can't. So if I can use her death to make some sort of a difference, to even just reach one person, to help one kid that's struggling, it brings some meaning at least. It brings something there for, you know, for me and for her. I try to hold myself pretty accountable and think of what she would want me to do. So a lot of what I do is driven on, you know, trying to make her proud or make her, you know.
Yeah. I know this is very difficult, but and again, the ability to have these conversations is unimaginable to me. I think there are a lot of parents that are out there, we talked a little bit about this before we started the show, who don't want to address this issue, who really, and no blame there, because how do you get your mind around that? You know, what's your message to those folks in terms of thinking that everything's fine and not necessarily delving a little deeper into that?
I guess for me, it's a scary topic. None of us really want to think about it. It's a taboo thing. We don't even talk about mental health. I mean, if you look at medical insurance, no matter how good your insurance is, it doesn't cover mental health until you hit your deductible for the year. But to parents, I think we always want to say, it's not my family, it's not my kid, it couldn't happen to us. And, when I talk at schools, I always say, it's kind of like pulling the blanket up over your head when you're a little kid. It doesn't make whatever was scary go away, it just makes you not prepared for it. So we have to have the conversations. And kids aren't always going to be comfortable talking to their parents. That's the other thing. I try to talk to the kids. They have to have an outlet. They have to feel like there's somewhere safe for them to go talk to, whether it's a guidance counselor and a friend. And I know kids today, friends can be difficult because your friend today, a month later is your frenemy. So how much do you divulge? How much do you tell them about what's really going on with you and then have it used against you? Yeah. So it's difficult for kids. Where do they turn? Who do they talk to? Who do they feel comfortable with? And then as parents, I think for us, it's very difficult to put our ego down sometimes. You know, what does it mean about me if my kid has mental health problems or if my kid's a bully or if my kid's... The reality is it doesn't mean anything about you. It's about your kids and what they need.
Yeah, I think, this is such an important conversation. And in order for these conversations to take place, you need leaders. And you are a leader. And Hannah is a leader. We are not going to see suicide addressed until individuals talk about it. And there's recently been a tragic circumstance in this community, which is very similar to what you're describing. And almost exactly the same. And to me, I think that we all kind of expect there's going to be bumps. There's going to be problems in raising children. They may have, issues with whatever. But you never expect that it's going to get to the point that we're having this conversation today. You think there'll be ups and downs, but you don't think it's going to... So I think that that's the most important piece, is to have the conversation not just about the underlying mental health conditions, but to have the conversation about suicide and what that means in terms of finality and what that means to the individuals that are around you. And you mentioned her siblings and you, talk a little bit about that aspect of things and the message that you have in regards to to suicide and presenting that to kids and to parents, because to me that's as difficult as it is, that's the most important piece of the conversation. Is yes, we need to be more open and honest in regards to mental health. We need to bring down the stigma. There needs to be a parity of mental health that comes from within the system, where when individuals go in for a checkup, it is seen as a par. But in terms of the suicide piece, I think that that's a societal element. And the same with cyberbullying, which we'll get to in a second.
Sure. I think the suicide piece itself, kids get to a place where they feel so alone or they feel so lonely that they turn to suicide, and it's their last option. And it's only after the fact that you realize how much love and support was around them.
Right.
They never saw. They didn't realize. Just in my own personal experience, between Hannah's wake, her funeral, the community support, the way that we were rallied around as a family and the love that was there for Hannah and the adoration that you could see from her friends, her peers, family members. There were people that didn't know her, that were impacted in a way that I never would have, conceived of until having to go through this. So I think for me, a lot of it is, kids feel like they're alone, they're overwhelmed, there's nobody there, there's no one that cares. And it's only after the fact they realize just how loved they are or how many people there are that would step up to support them and help them.
I've talked about this before, in my experiences, when you get to a place where you are so depressed that this becomes a thought, there is nothing else. Yeah. There is no nothing. All you see is the hole that you're in. You're not sure how you got there. There's not necessarily even rational reasons for it. It just kind of triggers. And, you know, you just kind of have to fight through that. And to me, that's the message, is because when you get there the first time, that's, in my view, where things could become problematic. But once you get through it and you realize, oh, this is just an extreme depressive moment, then other times occur after that. So I think that the most important thing for folks when they get to that point is to realize that this does not have to be a finality. It may feel like it should be, but that doesn't have to be the situation that you create.
Yeah, I mean, clinically, you know, I think people want to know about suicide, and I think a lot is known, but there's an awful lot that isn't known.
Correct.
And there are so many factors. You know, you think about depression as a disease, and that's exactly what it is. And it has its acute phases, and it has its less acute phases. And those suicidal thoughts are part of depression. There are also external factors that press down, especially on teenagers. And I think this is what you're relating to. That can exacerbate that, you know.
And they can be the littlest. They can be the littlest thing.
That's absolutely right.
That creates that trigger.
Right. And so you don't know. I don't know how another person, another human being, is going to react to something that is said, or a look, or anything. And I think that sort of preventative, we've called it here universal precautions. Yeah. Like, let's not be mean to anybody,
right?
Because you don't know how that's going to be received. And I certainly get that message from you.
Yeah, and we talked about that a little before the show. It's one of the things when I do talk with kids, you know, you don't know what anyone else has going on behind their eyes, what's going on in their life, what's going to impact them one way or another. A lot of us, especially when we're struggling, we walk through our days looking for signs. And something as simple as you making eye contact and smiling at somebody and saying hi could be a sign to them that it's going to be a good day and they're going to make it through, and they're going to make it through to tomorrow. On the flip side of that, being unkind or doing something unthoughtful could be a sign to them that that's the day. That's the day that they've just had enough, and that was the, you know, the hair that broke the camel's back, if you will. So we talked a little. I work with some student athletes, and one of the things that I give them as a message is, your leaders, you know, your peers look up to you. So in school, go to that table that has the one or two kids that sit by themselves that don't have a lot of friends. You don't have to become best friends. You don't have to be their prom date. Sit down with them and say hi. Ask them how their day is. You know, ask them what their name is if you don't know what their name is. Or just, you know, being friendly, being nice. It doesn't take any time or effort away from you. It takes nothing away from you. But you don't realize the kind of impact it could have on someone else and what it could mean to them.
The thing is, too, that I feel that there's so many individuals that struggle with mental health issues throughout the course of our society that, you know, you get into a place where if you're down, then at times you want to bring other folks down with you. But that, to me, has the worst possible effect on you as an individual, and obviously on society as a whole. The kid who doesn't want to sit with the other kids at the table because they are angry about things in their own life, that you, at times, particularly when you're younger, the folks that are doing the bullying are very often the ones that are the most affected by mental health issues. And the message that I would say to the bully is that your own life, your own pain will get better when you're nicer to people. You will feel better about yourself, and you'll make another person feel better when you are kind to that other person. And a lot of times, you know, kids and myself included, we're very cynical. And so, like, you're like, oh, this being nice to you, that's great. But the fact of the matter is that you will feel better about yourself, and your own life will get better when you're going through pain. You know, bringing another person down because they're an easy target is not something that is going to make you feel any better in the long run.
No, I would agree. And I liken it to hatred and anger. You know, after everything that happened, a contentious divorce, losing my daughter, there's a lot of animosity
there. No question.
And to hold on to that's like a cancer. It yep. affects your life, and it affects everything in your life and everyone around you in your life. You have to get to a place where you can let it go, and you have to, you know, you have to make some hard decisions, and you have to come to some hard realizations. But when you're able to do that and you're able to let it go, it doesn't just affect you. It affects everyone in your life and everyone that's touched by you. So letting go of the hate, the anger, and like you say, often I think it's the kids that are doing the bullying mm-hmm. that have some tough stuff going on. They right. didn't become that yeah. way, just, but they didn't wake up and decide, I'm going to be a bully today. Mm-hmm. If you really look into it from a mental health perspective, those are kids that are struggling. Those are often their kids that have stuff going on at home that's not okay, and they take it out on other people.
You know, one of the things I'm really interested in is how do you create an environment in school system? Because, you know, I know it's a long time, but I remember being in school a long time ago. But, you know, oftentimes it's a hotbed of nastiness. You know, there are groups, there are factions, there are people who want somebody one rung below them on the ladder that they can sort of make fun of because they don't want to be made fun of themselves.
Right.
It's a difficult, there's a developing brain thing going on there. There is also this notion of, I don't believe that many teenagers have sort of grappled with the notion of irreversibility of suicide, to be honest with you.
No.
I think sometimes it's a concept, and you can get contagions, you can get clusters. I've been involved in two, one on Nantucket and one in South Boston, where, you know, it's the ultimate sort of, society doesn't care about me, I don't care about them, I'm going to take my life. And there isn't a great deal of thought about irreversibility. So I'm really, at the work you're doing in high schools is
there's remarkable. Theological aspects at play as well.
Yes. Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. It's a whole soup of stuff. Yeah. But how do you create an atmosphere in a school that reverses that? You know, there is the zero suicide, for instance. There are people like you who come and speak about it. And I bet you there are children who come up to you after you've spoken.
Yes.
I bet you there are and say, I thought I was the only one feeling like this. I cannot believe you have described my life.
I can tell you that in the first 6 months after my daughter passed, my house was never empty. I had kids coming by that had been friends of hers, some that didn't even know her. They just felt like it was a safe place because of what we had been through. I could understand, and I could listen to them, and they could talk. Double-edged sword, you got to be careful. Some kids do open up and tell you they're at risk, and you've got to know how to handle mm-hmm. that and where to
yeah.
go with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, every time that I talk, I've got kids that will come up, and I made the mistake one of the first times I did it. I said, if you honestly feel like there's nowhere to turn and nowhere to talk to, and I had my cell phone number up. So that's my cell phone number. Call me day or night. Got a lot of phone calls. Mm-hmm. So we
yeah.
moved away from that.
Yeah.
But it is. You ask about setting up that environment in the schools. You know, I don't know if there is a specific answer that's the right one. I think it's a lot of trial and error, but you know, having resources available for kids, letting them know. And I know they're all tech savvy now, so like the suicide hotline yeah. isn't as popular, but there's a text hotline. Mm-hmm. You know, kids can text, and that's their thing.
Oh, really?
Hell, if we could have a Snapchat hotline, we'd probably do well there, too.
Right.
Yeah. That's not a bad idea.
But, you know, making resources available to kids, letting them know what those resources
are. And meeting
are.
Where they are.
Yes, that's the thing. Getting them where they are so you're not asking them to make a paradigm shift to find mm-hmm. help. It's right there where they are every day. I think that's a big part of it.
So what about things like the signs of suicide that a lot of schools do, which is creating peers, mm-hmm. Identifying children who are mature and who get this and can talk about it, who can have those conversations. So you're not talking with a counselor, you're not talking with a teacher, you're actually having those conversations with trained kids who know how to handle that, and importantly know how to get those kids who are vulnerable to a place where they can get help.
I think it's a great idea. If you can, then the question is, how do we build the trust? You have to be able to get yeah. that trust factor so that the kid that's struggling is going to feel comfortable opening up. And then the training piece is going to be huge, because the kids then that are the peers, they have to have the training to understand if somebody is at risk, mm-hmm. what are the signs that it's a significant risk and this needs to go somewhere, because there needs to be some sort of an intervention mm-hmm. here.
And I think you make it a really good point, too, about trust and information like this. And, you know, Peter and I talk a lot about how important peer support is. But amongst adults generally, there is a feeling that if someone's in the same boat as them, it is wrong to use the type of information against them or to spread that information to other people. kids, it can be different. There's not the life experience there, and there's not necessarily the boundaries where if you share things in a peer support group in a high school or middle school setting, that may end up getting, quote unquote, as you referenced before, used against them. So I think there's an important discussion about what is the best setting. I feel like there needs to be significant mental health professional, significant amount of in mental health professionals in schools to address these issues in a way that's more structured and is confidential as well. And I think that that's an important direction to go in. We also talked a little bit before off air about what can be done in regards to statute. And we are a country that has very strong free speech laws, and I'm a huge proponent of that. But there is a fine line, in my view, where when speech causes pain, and go the fire in the movie theater analogy, when speech causes pain, when speech causes individuals to commit acts of violence, should it carry a weight that is outside of the constitutional protections that are afforded? What are your feelings on that?
You're right. It's a very difficult topic because it's a double-edged sword. You want to be able to hold people accountable, but at the same time,
particularly in the issue of cyberbullying.
Cyberbullying, yeah. Especially when it leads to a suicide or attempted suicide. Like in my daughter's example, there was a cyberbullying aspect there. Some kids were doing some really nasty things on Snapchat, and it was, when we were younger, you got a break from bullying when you went home. Mm-hmm. That was your safe place.
Right.
Now, cyber, with the social media, it's 24/7. There is no escape. I mean, my daughter was getting messages 2, 3, 4 in the morning all night long from kids like with some really nasty stuff. So they don't have an escape from it. And so to me, the emotional piece says absolutely the law in New Hampshire is cyberbullying or bullying is a misdemeanor no matter what. So I do think there should be a law on the books where at least a DA has discretion to charge it as a felony if it leads to a suicide or attempted suicide. But now you open Pandora's box to that fine line of where does it infringe on free speech? You know, who's the one that makes that decision and what are the qualifications to make that decision?
Right.
You know, the recent case down in Massachusetts, I think, set some precedent where the girl who had told her boyfriend to commit suicide, she ended up being held accountable.
Yeah.
So it sets some sort of a precedent. But, I don't know that I have the right answer. And, of course, I've got emotion based on my own experience.
Exactly.
So I want to see a law in the books that has a little teeth to it or at least gives discretion to a DA. But at the same time, how do you balance that with our constitutional rights?
Yeah, I mean,
and the element of, as Peter described as well, where suicide is there is no one particular way unless – there's a circumstance where the individual says and is very clear about the fact that, as is in the case of Massachusetts, is the reason as to why they did it. If they give, they say, this is why, then you have that aspect of it. But then you get into kind of the legality of a person's own choice versus being coerced into doing that. But there's also precedent for that.
Yeah.
And, if a person, if I tell, Peter to commit a crime, I am the person who at time that can be held more responsible for that as being the mastermind of said crime if I tell Peter to do something.
Yeah, I mean, anybody knows me probably would call me a woolly liberal, but on this one, I think law and order has an absolute place for this. And I think about the kid Holly that was out in Northampton a few years ago, the kid that came from Ireland, and there was this ring of bullying, and those kids were held responsible. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
We remember what happened with the cyberbullying with the girl who was facing the consequences of that. I think it's a combination of a number of things. This idea of zero tolerance for suicide, and that's just a message that we have to keep pushing. We have to keep talking about this is, a permanent solution for a temporary problem, and I think that resonates with young people. But we also have to hold people accountable because that makes people think. There's no question about that. Oh, my behavior will be held accountable if something goes wrong. So there's a low probability of a negative outcome, but there are high consequences when that does happen. And I think that's the message we have to get through to developing minds. Think twice about what you do, because the consequence of what you're doing may have a lifetime effect on you and may cost somebody's life.
And of course, laws for minors can also be different than laws for, and because the consequences are also different as well, being charged as a minor for a cyberbullying incident and what happens as a result of that.
Well, and that's another really big piece that you bring up, and it's a great point. Before this experience, I would not have known. It's actually middle school that's probably worse than high school.
Yes.
The kids are younger and younger and starting to be more and more vicious at a young age.
So and are testing their limits.
Yeah. And so even if you get a law on the books that has teeth to it and you can charge, you know, as a felony, what if the kid's a seventh grader that's, you know, 12 years old?
Mm-hmm.
How do you charge that kid with a felony and you know, potentially ruin yet another life?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the right answer is. I don't know what the balance is, but it has to be looked at. You know, we have to try to come up with something better than what we have today.
And I think that for the time being, this is a situation that, as we kind of bring it back full circle, that needs to be regulated by parents and regulated by kids. And, you know, as you referenced, kids are getting messages and are receiving messages at 2, 3, 4 in the morning, and it's the cell phone is constant, and I totally get that as an individual who some may say is addicted to my cell phone.
I wouldn't say that.
But the just because if you text me and I respond to you within 5 seconds doesn't mean I'm addicted to it.
I like that.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Everybody likes it. But I can put away my cell phone for the weekend, and I can put it away and not check it at 2 in the morning. And I have to know to do that. And as a parent, you know, instilling that in your kids. Yes, this is the way that society is now, but just as, you know, smoking was the norm in the 1950s and 60s, you don't have to have your phone all the time. You know, we're going to have a weekend without phones and stuff like that to try to, you know, detach, because we always, you know, look to government to solve our problems. And the fact of the matter is that government only solves our problems when we as individuals make them do it.
Yes.
So all of this has to start at the, you know, the grassroots level. We create our own solutions, and like you are doing, and what you are doing to me is absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
Because you have taken a situation that is the worst circumstance that I could imagine as a parent, and you have opened your heart and opened your home, and you have moved forward and said, I am going to make a bad situation a good situation. And that is the type of positivity that we need in our society. And, you know, we're kind of starving for in a lot of ways. And I think that that's such an important message, perhaps more so than, you know, the cyberbullying and the suicide side of things, is to make just a positive impact. And if something has gone wrong, you can either be upset about it and blame other people and, you know, go in that anger direction, or you can go in the positive direction. And if that takes place, I think that's all the other problems get solved that you're talking about.
You make a great point when it comes to, you know, government's only going to legislate when we force them to. It has to start at home. It has to be grassroots. Mm-hmm. The technology piece is big. And I understand. I'm as guilty as anybody. I live by my cell phone. I run a medical device company. So I'm 24/7 nonstop on my phone, to the point where my kids will give me grief. they're on their phones all the time.
Right.
So and maybe we can't put it down for an entire weekend. I get that. Some people, it's not realistic.
Right.
Start small. What we've done at home is at dinner time, there are no cell phones allowed at the dinner table, no screen time during dinner, including myself. It goes on vibrate, and there's not an emergency that can't wait 45 minutes. We sit down and we talk to each other. And that's the tough thing, too. I think sometimes you ask your kids, how was your day? Fine.
Yeah.
How was your day? Fine.
Word.
How are you? Good.
Yeah.
So we do this little thing. We call it best and worst. At dinner, you go around. What was your best part of your day? What was your worst part of your day? And the best part can't be having dinner with your family, because it's a cop-out.
Right.
So, you know, what was your best part of the day today? What was your worst part? And the parents and the kids participate. So now kids don't often get to hear about
our day. But this is the best
either.
Part of my day, Dad.
Yes, right? You know, that's usually the worst part of the day because I'm making them answer.
I've got that cell phone.
But, you know, it's and as parents, we often don't talk to our kids and tell them what's going on with us.
Right.
I think sometimes that sets up a barrier where they feel like they can't
You're so right.
We're so busy. We don't unplug from our own stuff. They feel like, I don't want to put anything else on mom or dad's plate because they're so busy.
Right. Or you're vague and you give them and you they know that you're not being completely forthcoming with them either. And like, well, okay, this is how we roll here. So that's what I'm going
to
do.
So to unplug and to say, hey, guys, here was the best part of my day and here's why and here's what I did. Or, hey, I actually have two bests because today was really good. And then here's the worst part of the day. But to actually explain it more than just a fine or a good. And then we rate it on a score of 1 to 10. How would you rate your day? It's, again, it's 10 minutes. But it's probably the most valuable 10 minutes of our day. And I travel a lot for work, so I have a full-time nanny that's at home. But there's a lot of overnights. So when I am home and we're able to sit down and have dinner together as a family, I want to try to have that peace. And luckily, that goes back to the screen time. When I do travel, my kids are great about texting and staying in touch. But again, I think the grassroots part, trying to do it at home and maybe it's baby steps. Maybe it's simply we all put our phones down at dinner time and nobody has phone, you know, the phones with them at dinner, and then see if we can expand that into a Friday night or a Saturday night or, you know.
Well, Jason, really appreciate your time. We're, again, so thankful and really, honestly, in awe of what you're doing. And anything that we can do to be supportive of you as you move this process forward and get this message out, I'm more than willing to do whatever you you wish.
I greatly appreciate that. We are in the process of finalizing the 501(c)(3) paperwork right now for it's going to be the Hannah Grace Bazemore Foundation. So my hope is sometime this summer to have the website up and running and to have the foundation running full-fledged. We do a couple of cheer competitions at the Hollis Brookline High School. The coach, Carrie Marsh, over there has been wonderful helping me put that together as fundraisers. Like I say, I do some talking at some schools. And eventually I'd like to look at maybe even being able to do it via like a live podcast. So I can touch more than one school at a time. My bandwidth is limited. So if now I could do it as a podcast and talk to 10 schools at the same time instead of one and visiting, you know, 5 schools a year, you know, get the message out there. And the goal of the foundation is the funds that we raise outside of awareness and trying to bring awareness. What we want to do really is address the fact that our healthcare system is broken, especially when it relates to mental health. So there are a lot of families that have needs. They just don't have the means.
Yeah.
So if the foundation can sponsor even one family a year, never mind 15, 20, 30 families a year and cover the cost of mental health for their children, then I'll feel like we're really doing something.
You know, I'm thinking right now, Peter, that you know, something that would be really beneficial perhaps would be to create an interface where you're able to talk with first you have a video that's played and you talk about the situation that's taken place, some individuals who think and talk about mental health and suicide who are high-profile individuals who have dealt with that and produce a video and then have you know, a conversation where you interface with kids across the state, because I think that this, as the state moves towards discussing mental health in a more significant way, we need to meet kids where they are, as we talked about before, and having a video that catches their attention first, prior rather than, you know, having a person, you know, show up and say, "Hi, I'm Jason," or "I'm Chris," and
"Yeah,
I'm
who
here
are
talking,
you?"
I'm here to talk about suicide. So you give yourself some credibility early on with you know, high profile individuals, kids that are relatable, who have gone through situations, who are you know, high school age or college age. And you know, really hit kids, and then have the question and answer after that, either in person or an interface. I think is a good, you know, project that I am proposing on the show. we'll figure that out as we move forward. Jason, again, thanks so much for your time,
Absolutely. And
we look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you both for your work.
All right, this is I'm Listening here on KXL. I am Chris Ryan, along with Peter Evers. We'll come back and wrap things up after this. I'm Listening is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 139, 1450 and NHTalkRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan along with Peter Evers. We're just joined by Jason Bazemore, who is a leader, an individual who has a compelling story that he is telling. He is taking a tragic circumstance and is making the community and the state better as a result of that. And, you know, these are the types of stories that we need to tell. We hear so much about, you know, the bad things in society. If it bleeds, it leads and such. Mm-hmm. But this is an individual who has been faced with the greatest tragedy imaginable as a parent and has said, I am going to make this into a positive. I'm going to save lives. And that's the type of person, in my view, that needs to be celebrated.
What an interview. I mean, remarkable human being. And I think somebody that we all want to be. Faced with that kind of tragedy, putting yourself in the middle of a solution is actually a great recovery exercise for any individual who goes through that. You know, he is saying exactly the right things. He's saying, be mindful of what you say. Be mindful of your words. Assume that everybody, you know, is fragile before you go on, and create an environment where people can talk about this so we can prevent this happening in the future. And, you know, he's one of the points of light out there, and I take my hat off to the work that he's doing. It's remarkable.
Power of positivity. If you are suffering, if there is pain, it makes you feel better. Bringing other individuals down just because you're feeling down, the opposite. And I think that it's such an important message. Peter, as always, great to see you, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks, Chris.
That is Peter Evers, CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health, joining us here for I'm Listening on KXL 139, 1450 and NHTalkRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate joining us for the show.